Hi, I'm Alex. This is Six Seasons in a Podcast, the podcast dedicated to conversations with the writers, creators, and actors of the hit comedy community. This week, I'm talking with writer Alex Rubens, whose work includes Key and Peele, The Twilight Zone, and a little show called Rick and Morty. Maybe you heard of it. Alex Rubens, welcome to Six Seasons in a Podcast.
Thank you so much. It's really nice to be here.
It's wonderful to talk to you. We've kind of dated for a few weeks now in trying to set this up. You are a super busy man working on Rick and Morty and other works.
It is like dating. I've noticed one thing. Have you noticed this? I haven't heard people comment on this. I'm just going to waste all of our time talking about side topics.
Let's do it.
When you're making plans with someone, if you have a few backs and forths, that's how you say that. By the time you actually encounter each other, it's as if you already like creates a relationship. Like scheduling creates a relationship.
Yeah. It's I think at a certain point in our back and forth, it was like, oh, this is a friend now. I think we cross a threshold in
old
the So it's wonderful.
Threshold.
Yes, it was intentional usage. So I was going to say that what I think you're most famous for at this point is pitching the brainy gremlin in Gremlins 2.
Yes, I am in the Gremlins 2 sketch. I've mentioned several times that people keep telling me I wrote that sketch. Enough so that as the years have passed, I get confused. But then the reason this story is already in brackets is that I started getting self-conscious where I'm like, oh, am I responsible at this point for that confusion? Because every time I say, people say I wrote it, it's like, I don't know, it's like wag the dog, it's like politician being like, there's no truth to the rumors that my opponent is a murderer of prostitutes, and you're like, wait, you just created that rumor. But I swear I didn't. But I am in that in part, and I'm not an actor, and it is because of the reason why people get confused about me in that sketch, because that Jordan and I were working together before Key and Peele, and he knew I loved that sketch, which he came up with before Key and Peele. And I think I may have reminded him of one or two of the gremlins. I think maybe I reminded him that the flying bat gremlin gets concrete on him and turns into a gargoyle or something like that. I don't know. That doesn't sound like something Jordan would have forgotten. So maybe, I don't know. Maybe I just reminded him of something stupider than that.
You just created another rumor.
Yeah, I just made
another inception. Yeah.
People always say that Jordan considers me his muse. And I'm like, I don't know where they got that.
Well, I wanted to just point that one out because later there's another Gremlins reference, and clearly there's a Gremlins thing here.
I'm a little obsessed with certain things.
Yeah, it's a great movie, a pair of movies. All right, so I usually start out with question about like what kind of shows did you grow up watching?
I wasn't one of those households where my parents controlled my TV watching for better or for worse, mostly for better, I think. Most of my friends who grew up watching like Three's Company, I think when they look back, they're like, oh yeah, I don't know if that was very good, that show. Although to be actually, I don't mean to talk shit about Three's Company. Like I've never seen it because I've got these weird holes. I'm 43 and there are all these sitcoms that I should have seen and didn't, like Full House or some of the other ones. But I definitely watched cartoons. I watched The Muppet Show. Probably the shows as a kid that made the biggest impression on me were like The Muppet Show and Muppet Babies. Muppet Babies is interesting because it's got a lot of meta fourth wall shit in it, and Chuck Lorre wrote for it, which is, Chuck Lorre is a fascinating character. At this point, I think everybody knows that he wrote the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles theme song.
Not know that. That's amazing.
Chuck Lorre, and he was I think he was on the staff of Muppet Babies.
Wow,
which is such a like interesting backstory for this person who's such this like huge success. But yeah, no, I mean, I think I grew up with cartoons and Muppets, and then my parents like taped a bunch of reruns of shows that we would watch like over dinner. So they showed me a bunch of Cheers. They showed me a bunch of Taxi. They showed me, and I remember as a little kid, like while like them watching MASH while they were having dinner, and I was just sort of like clinging to them. So a lot of commercials and early 80s sort of just general television noise is in my head.
Did you watch any G.I. Joe?
Yeah, a little bit. Okay. Although that you're reminding me that was Transformers and He-Man were important to me.
Okay.
In the earlier 80s, mid early 80s. G.I. Joe, like, I didn't get as much into, partly because, I mean, actually, it was probably my parents doing. They're sort of like anti-militaristic or something. Yeah. Like, no, we don't want you to watch the soldier show. They don't want me to watch the screaming skullhead show, the robots right. shooting each other lasers show. Star Wars, that's the only kind of wars allowed in the Rubens household. That was where I came from. A lot of movies. Like, I mean, I used to watch a lot of movies as a kid. Ghostbusters and Gremlins are very big ones.
Nice.
For me, Goonies. Anything starting with the G.
When you're in a writer's room, do you like your background? You know, like my wife tried to watch Community, and I think she was even more sheltered. I would say a lot more sheltered than
I had to watch.
And so she doesn't quite get a lot of the jokes. And so do you find, you know, did you have to do a lot of homework when you're in a writer's room, or it sounds like you had a lot of influences and a lot, you weren't like sheltered. It was just,
yeah. I mean, there's also I was very steeped in pop culture. It's just, okay. There's this weird little hole of actual sitcom watching when I was a kid. But the, like, Different Strokes and Silver Spoons, or I'm trying to think of it. But I heard about all of it. And then again, also, like, a lot of the stuff I was into as a kid was, you know, consumed and regurgitated pop culture, like, you know, like Community did in some ways. So, like, Muppet Babies was meta and referenced the culture. They were in Mad Magazine was like, of course, all about that.
Yeah.
Even the Muppet Show, right? Muppets and comedy like SNL. Looney Tunes was constantly referencing popular culture from the 30s or something. Yeah. You know, like, so I think that, like, I was very like a sponge for it, but just had this one avenue turned off. So I also find with Community, my wife also, like, she prefers Rick and Morty to Community, which sort of surprised me. I would have thought she would have preferred Community, but I think it's because Community, has that self-referential kind of sitcom awareness to it. And I think you can watch, if you're not particularly delighted by any meta kind of stuff, you can still fully immersed in Rick and Morty. But if that kind of irony and self-awareness sort of turns you off, I think that can be a roadblock for Community.
Interesting. I wonder when did you first create, and what were you creating, what kind of drove you to get into entertainment?
It happened real early. I mean, I literally, as long as I remember, I thought of myself as being a writer. And it was a big moment for me fairly late in life when I realized, like, that, because I thought I wanted to be a novelist, fiction writer.
Okay.
And it kind of hit me, if I really traced that back to the joy that I used to, because it became, like, you know, source of great stress and, like, angst and self-loathing and, like, I don't know if I'm any good. And also, the novel tends to be, these high art pretensions to it, and I realized that when I really traced back to where I loved writing, it came from watching TV and movies. And I didn't have the director bug, and also, like, I just didn't see how, like, a lot of people are like, how do I make a movie? And then they figure it out. Mm. But I was like, oh, I also like books. So I'm like, okay, well, books are movies you can make. You know, you can just do that without having to film anything or have a camera or something. And
in high school, were you writing, you know, pretty consistently?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, really, since I was, like, for as long as I can remember. I mean, I used to dictate stories to my mom. I have these, like, things, these, like crudely drawn things with my mom's handwriting, because I would be like, and then Luke Skywalker, like, grabbed his lightsaber and cut Salacious Crumb in half. There was lots of Star Wars, lots of Ghostbusters, Gremlins, Pac-Man. I liked, you know, I basically was writing spec scripts, but I thought of them as being books, and then by the time I was in high school, yeah, I was like trying to write short stories and stuff, and like I wrote a lot of stuff, and then this big turning point happened for me relatively late in life again. I was already, I think I was like 30 when I was like, wait, why am I not pursuing a career as a Hollywood writer? I mean, honestly, full disclosure, my thought process was like, I like that at least as much as I like novels, and it seems easier. I mean, I was like, if it just seemed easier and was a step down in what I cared about, then I'd be like, oh, that's a book. Or also, it pays better, you know.
Yeah, sure. So
I'm like, like much more. And it's really not easy to break in, but it's probably easier to break in than it is to breaking into supporting yourself by being a novelist. Yeah. And again, like I had a block to that. I was slow to make that jump, partly because I was like, well, that's called selling out. And then I realized, no, that's called selling out if you're doing it just because you think you can make a buck.
Yeah.
But frankly, the big revelation for me was like, I'd be at least as proud to be a writer on The Simpsons as I would be to have written a novel like this or that novel. You know, like I value The Simpsons, Ghostbusters, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Star Wars. These are things that I love at least equally to the novels and fiction that I love. So once I got that through my head and then shifted course, then it changed my life. So in one sense, I've always been writing. In another sense, I was doing a certain kind of writing and then realized, wait a minute. I think the reason I was doing the one kind of writing was because I didn't think I could do the other kind. And then I realized, wait, no, actually the other kind is not only what I would prefer to be doing, but it's easier. Well, no, it's not easier to, I don't know if it's necessarily easier, but it's easier to get in.
Yeah.
And that's still hard, but.
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, you know, someone like Andy Bobrow, who got into writing in his 40s,
yeah.
You know, so, you know, I think it's,
for me, it was my 30s. And by the way, I'm really grateful for that, because most of the people I've worked with, you know, got sort of started having success almost immediately, or relatively to me. And having spent, you know, a decade slowly learning that I would never do what I wanted to do, ended up, I've come to realize, ended up being a real strength, because it makes it impossible for me to make the mistake it kind of makes me less insecure, because anytime I get anything other than positive feedback, I'm not thrown like, oh my God, wait a minute, what if the whole thing is crumbling? Whereas I think if you all, I have a couple of friends who just always had success and always got validation. And ironically, like, I think they're more vulnerable than I am to bumps in the road. They're more thrown by it because they're not used to it. Whereas I'm like, oh yeah, I know what it feels like to be a loser. Like, I know what it feels like to that's what I am. Like, I'm a failure who then lucked into, you know, getting, I mean, those terms are toxic, obviously, but like, those are the terms that like claw in you. And I had to, unlike some of the people I know, I had to realize, like, well, that's not your value and worth in life and your source of happiness can't be pegged to validation, 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 success, success, success. And you know, so it ironically, the people who have just kept winning the lottery again and again and again are you know, have major exposed bellies like Smog or whatever. Like, yeah, I can never mistake myself for my career. Like, I actually had to learn that I'm a human being in the world.
I think that's really insightful. And I think it's great advice for, you know, people listening and, you know, cause whatever you're doing, whatever you're pursuing in life, if it's about the success, if it's about, and if you never had the road bumps and those kinds of things.
Yeah. And I think maybe there are ways in which it's even nice to have something like this, but it's easy to view your own life as if it's a success failure story, you know, and to judge yourself based on what you are or aren't doing, what your dreams are or aren't. And I think the fact is, like, I mean, you meet the most successful people in the world, and like, there is a difference between like happiness levels, you know, depending on, you know, how easily you can pay the rent, you know, but in the end, like, you can be a very, very unhappy, very, very successful person. And I think the real source of, this podcast is about happiness and fulfillment, right? Is that?
I've been listening to Brené Brown, if you know who that is. If I give, I'm probably going to say something like, say more, say more. I was listening to her and she's got these lines and I'm like, oh, I got to use those lines. And anyway, so if I say,
yeah, well, like, more, how, I mean, like, I'm more and more like I love writing and I love my job. But I mainly feel lucky, you know, all sorts of lucky in all sorts of directions, because it's just like a fluke that I get to do this, you know. It feels nice to have successes in it. But one of the things I love about Dan Harmon's writing, and this is true in Community and it's true in Rick and Morty, is that I think of him as being in a tradition that includes like Mark Twain and Kurt Vonnegut and David Foster Wallace and George Saunders, a bunch of white guys, but these satiric, like, they're all super almost brutal, cynical, incredibly optimistic people. You know, like, their work, including Harmon, always sort of has a moral. Like, I mean, that's the thing about Community, is that he wants every story he tells, he wants it to have a sitcom happy ending. He's just absolutely unwilling to fake it. So that's part of the reason that the things go so dark sometimes, is that if he's like, okay, I want to have a story where these two people recognize their friendship, it has to be earned and it has to go through. And this is sort of, in a way, how the story circle works. It has to go through a place of acknowledging all the ways in which it's bullshit. Like, in order to get to a place where you're like, I love my baby daughter, you have to go through, life is meaningless, it's an accident that we're alive, we're all gonna die. Like, I mean, if you refuse to face those truths, then, you know, the really, really hard, you know, Brené Brown place to hit kind of requires recognizing all the bad things. Because as long as you're shoving those things aside, then you know on some level that the truth, that the happy ending you've gotten to is a little bit artificial. You're like, oh great, oh cool, I got this. And I think that's part of what I love about Dan Harmon's work, and the shows he's made, is that they can be mistaken, I think, for incredibly mean-spirited sometimes because they're cynical, but it's all in the service of this of wanting to get somewhere positive. He doesn't want an episode to end with like, well, like, life is horrible and we are all monsters. The end. See you next week. Like, no, he doesn't want to do that.
Yeah.
But he also can't bring himself to lie about any of it.
I think let's talk about that when we get to season six, because think there's a lot of, in the fandom, you know, I've picked up at this point that there's definitely like, there's a different vibe going on here in season six. So we'll get there. I'd love to, for you in your story progression, let's get us to LA and you know, how you got started in the business. And
Sure.
You know, Key & Peele was your first TV gig, right?
Yeah, it was. Yep. And it was 11 years after I graduated from college, and and I spent 10 years writing and trying to make ends meet and doing this job and that job and then quitting and then getting a new job and running out of money and building up savings. And which, by the way, also coming from a place of relative privilege, some of those ends meeting were at the easy level, you know, a beginner level, making ends. Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't have college debt. That's the big, one. I was just talking to a friend of mine who's turning 60 and just paid off his college debt. And I didn't have that. My parents were able to pay my tuition. And that's just like, you know, I think people are more and more conscious of this, about how that's like, oh, okay, well, that's my big break. Like, my lucky break is like, I got born. I mean, you know, now obviously there's so many different levels of this stuff. It's not like we wanted for nothing and I could have whatever I wanted and I didn't have to work. But it is the case that I didn't have to pay off college debt, and that in a way, that's the end of the story, you know. So that's one of a long list of incredibly lucky things that that's part of the, you know, that's why I was saying part of the reason why I'm like, I can only view my life as just like incredible good fortune. So for about 10 years, you know, not rich enough that I didn't have to worry about paying the rent and didn't have to make ends meet and wasn't miserable and freaking out and scrounging and pinching pennies and tightening my belt, but rich enough that I wasn't only focused on trying to pull myself out of a hole. I was starting from a level ground that a lot of people never even get to, and that made it a lot easier. I don't know if I would have made it 10 years, but 10 years of struggle with trying to break in, you know, make it as a writer, failing, increasingly feeling like, oh, maybe I'm just a delusional, what's the incredibly cruel way I can refer to myself, but insert here whatever you're thinking about me. Yeah, the big change came, as I referenced earlier, but I think this is, we were already rolling. I don't know.
Yeah.
So, but it hit me. I was like, I kind of didn't understand what TV writing was, which is, I think, hard for younger people to see now. And now it's so, at some point in the last 15 years or so, I think people got way more conscious of comedy as a, like, when I was a kid, people wanted to be movie stars or rock stars or athletes. And now I think they want to be movie stars, rock stars, athletes, or comedians, right? I remember reading some article about that. So I think people are much more aware. Also, when I was in college, improv was like a relatively new thing, or not new, but it wasn't like every college had an improv team. Certainly not every high school. And so anyway, I kind of didn't understand what writers' rooms were. I didn't understand how it happened. And once I became aware of it, my first thought was like, oh, fuck, I wish I had known that. Now it's too late. And when I moved to LA, a couple of people told me I was too old. I was 32. But I moved to LA because I was like, okay, well, I have to just make it or break it on this. Like, I can't just like be coasting on a kind of like, I'm almost broke, I need to take a new job, and now it means I can't write anymore, or like I'm scrounging with the writing, and then I'm like, save up money, and then I quit, and then I just had to like do all or nothing. And then and just when my bank account was like, apparently this happens to a bunch of people, I think it's just when my bank account was like about to hit zero was when I got the Campbell job. And that also was a ludicrously fortunate, just dumb luck thing, which was that when I moved out to LA, one of the first people that I hung out with was Jordan Peele, because he was living in LA and he was a really, really good friend of my best friend in New York.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They had known each other as kids. And he was my friend's, you know, famous comedian friend, because he had been on Mad TV and he was doing Obama impressions on Funny or Die. And I was like, and my friend was always like, he's so awesome, so funny, and so talented, and so brilliant. And we had just met in New York, a month or so before I moved out to LA, and then went out there and hung out with them, and we hit it off like almost more creatively than anything else. We started writing together almost immediately.
Oh wow!
Not a strategic thing on my. It would have been smart if I had been like, just... you know what I should do is I should collaborate with this guy. Like I couldn't have planned it better. But I don't really think that way. So, but we hit it off and about Gremlins basically, and started writing our own. We kind of were like, people don't, and now they do again with like Stranger Things and whatnot, but this is before Super 8 even, and we were kind of like, why aren't there any of those Amblin movies anymore? So yeah, we started writing together, and then soon after that he got Key and Peele.
Yeah,
I was able to submit to be a writer on Key and Peele only because he and I had written together already and he liked writing with me.
Nice.
So again, like lucky break upon lucky break, you know, like I was fortunate enough to be able to be in a situation where I was able to be writing with Jordan before I was getting paid to do it. And I was fortunate enough to have met Jordan through a friend. And I was fortunate enough that the timing worked out. And then I was able to submit for a Key and Peele. And the place that isn't pure luck is that they liked my writing.
Yeah,
but I wouldn't have had that opportunity. You know, I mean, yeah, they weren't like, but it wasn't like the John Stewart packet that I saw online recently, where like they made a point of being like, we don't want agents. I didn't quite follow the story, but I saw people referencing it that like, you know, a million people could submit their packet for John Stewart. And I think he really did hire from. Actually, I shouldn't talk about things I don't know, but I. Yeah. It wasn't like that. It wasn't open submissions. I was in a very, very fortunate little category. And then Key and Peele was successful. And then I had a career, which allowed me to work with Dan Harmon.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is awesome. Did you have experience doing sketch comedy writing? I mean,
no. I did improv in college and I had written on my own like little comedy scripts and stuff.
Okay.
But I actually took a sketch writing class at UCB the year before, I think it was the year before I got the Key and Peele job. And it was partly because that first year when I was in LA and hanging out with Jordan, he was like, hey, my friend Keegan and I are working on this sketch show. And if it happens, maybe you can submit for it. So I was like, oh shit, I better learn how to write sketches. Yeah. And I took a sketch writing class and I really felt like I was like, oh, this is a thing I'm not good at. and Jordan kind of taught me how to write sketches. Mm.
Do you have a favorite sketch from the show?
I mean, Jordan's sketch, some of the stuff he wrote. I mean, one of the things that blew me away the most was that East-West Bowl football name sketch. Partly because like, I remember he handed it to me on, like, I came to work and he was like, hey, look at this. I wrote this last night. And it was, you know, minus the visual stuff and the amazing characterization stuff that they were doing. But like, I don't know if you studied sketch writing at all or like improv stuff.
I have not. So please.
Well, there's like, you know, there's a, especially in the, well, you know, one of the showrunners, one of the executive producers of the show is this guy Ian Roberts, who's one of the original four UCB guys, and his thing is this kind of like comedy game. There's like a structure, there are rules to it. And his brain is like an amazing comedy supercomputer that he can make, figure out. It's about heightening, and everybody's heard of like rules of three, the rule of three, you know, but there's also like heightening versus, you establish something, then you don't want to then go down and be less funny than the last one or less extreme. And what you don't do is just be like, be funny and then keep being funny. And then you're done, like until you're done. And one of the things that was amazing about that sketch to me is it was just a list of names and, they started at a 10 kind of, and somehow like in a way that sketch really shouldn't have worked. Like when you're watching it, most people, like, I feel like, and it was a very popular sketch, like it went over great, you know? And that was a testament in a way that almost is easy to miss, to the genius of Jordan's comedy writing, because like in a way it was like a tightrope. Like it's like it has pyrotechnics, so it doesn't feel like it's subtle. But the fact that he's able to like start with a ridiculous name, and then you, like in a way the reason for structure, and this goes from the story circle too, heightening in a comedy sketch story circle. I think of it almost as being like, why does the audience keep watching after minute two, you know, or after second 30? And because at a certain point you're like, oh, I get it. Like, and if you push pause, there's like no reason to keep watching, or you start getting bored. Like a minute can be very long if you don't have a, you know, trail of breadcrumbs you're following. And both the story circle and comedy heightening and stuff essentially give a shape to things that kind of is the answer to why am I continuing to watch and why am I not bored. And yeah, the football name sketch somehow has that shape and gets more ridiculous. And it's almost is like a magic trick. I think part of the joy of watching it, if especially if you're thinking about it, but I think even if you're not, on some level you're like, well, the next name can't be funny. Like I've already said, like Osmataz Buckshank, like what. I get it now. They're crazy names. And then you get hit with the next one and you're like, oh. And then you do want to
end with the white guy.
Yep. Oh yeah. And endings are hard too. Another sketch by Jordan that he was pitching in the writer's room, and like, I mean, this also has that like edge to it. It's like kind of explosive and like, oh my, like, which gives it this quality. But the auction block slave sketch. I don't know if you remember part of the genius is it's so about, it's not about slavery. Like slavery is the nuclear energy in it, but like it's about just like basic human ego, you know, and it's a relatable thing where you're like, you know, well, you know, it's almost like it's about where if you're dating someone and you want to break up and then they break up with you, you're like, what? No. Like, you know, cause it's like, there's, you know, they're standing on the auction block and they're like, whoever buys me, like better watch out. I'm gonna, you know, like, this bullshit, this is crazy. And then they keep not getting picked. And inevitably, and I think this is true, that on some level, part of you would be like, why did they pick that guy and not me? Like, would they not? And the sketch just like takes that and runs with it. And it's so amazing. That and it could just as easily have been about like serial killers or something, like, you know, it'd be like a set in a slasher movie, or it could have been about like aliens, like War of the Worlds, like some you know, the tripod people like snatching people up, and eventually you're like, they're never gonna grab me, like I'm right here, like because it was about slavery, it just has this extra like, oh my god, I can't, is this okay, like is it. That was an amazing sketch, and then the stuff of I wrote, I always have a soft spot for the Mr. T sketch, the song at the end. It was based on an actual Mr. T video about mothers, and this one was about, he ends up singing a song about hair, and I that one is one of the very few things that I've written that like when I watch it again I actually am like it kind of makes me laugh still. It's got a little bit of that magic for me where I'm still experiencing it as something that that came to me kind of. But I don't know. Yeah. Cool. It was great writing on that show. I mean, it was, a lot of really, really brilliant, hilarious people.
Yeah. It's a wonderful show. I'm glad I watched it start to finish. It was really great.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's jump into community.
Yeah. Well, when I first moved to LA, I was watching a lot of TV because I kind of felt like I had a deficit. Like I said, I didn't watch a lot of sitcoms growing up. So I was like watching every new show that came out, every pilot that came out, watching a lot of 30 Rock, a lot of Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And Community was the show that, like, I remember it was season two, the new, this doesn't really happen anymore, I guess, but it was like on some Thursday, you know, it's like all the new, you know, all the new shows and new seasons of shows were all starting, and Community just like immediately hooked me with, I started watching it on season two in that first episode. I think it was Donald Glover sitting up with like the Spider-Man shirt. And I'm like, what is this show? Mm-hmm. And then of course it's amazingly brilliant. And, I think I was already in love with it, but I think it was Abed's Uncontrollable Christmas that really made me be like, oh shit, this is, because it operates on so many levels at once. I'm like, it's a parody of a Christmas special, but it also really is a Christmas special, and there is a reason why it's in stop motion, and what we're watching somebody's delusion, except he is right because we're watching it. And then the message, it was like, I actually felt the feelings that I used to feel as a kid watching. And I'm Jewish. I wasn't raised as a Christmas, but those Christmas specials still have that like magic to them, even if you're not a celebrator. And that kind of like speech at the end, the winger speech in that one, like still almost like when they start singing the song, like it's, I almost like, I, if I'm in the right mindset, I can get teary-eyed about it. So I was like, this is so many things, so ridiculous, so silly, so funny. And that was what, I think that was when I was like, okay, I have to go back and watch season one. And then I watched, you know, all of it. And it was just without a doubt, my favorite show. And it was, there was no other show I would rather have written for. And also I think it was at that point that I was like, oh shit, wait, Dan Harmon created the Sarah Silverman program with, and then got fired from it, and Shrub, and then I was like watching Heat Vision and Jack, and then so by the time I started to have a TV writing career, I was like, fuck, I wish this had started a couple of years earlier, because Harmon got fired. And then I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm never gonna write on Community, because right when I was starting to be able to get jobs on shows that I liked, I was like, well, there's no more Community. Or there was, but I was definitely in the camp where I honestly haven't really seen season four. I've only seen a couple of episodes of it. Okay. And in retro, I probably would have a different attitude about it now, because so many brilliant and talented and hilarious people were involved, including the entire cast. But at the time, my feeling was it would be like, oh, there's a new, it's like 1971. There's a new Beatles album coming out. They fired John and Paul. And I'm like, no, you don't, like, what? So because of that, I was like, well, really, I wanted to work with Dan Harmon, you know, like, is what it kind of came down to. And I was like, well, that's that. And then when the news came out that he was coming back, that he was getting hired again, I literally, like, called all my reps and was like, I remember talking to my manager, making a pitch for what, like really, really, I've never pushed for something like this where I was like, I really think I should. And I remember on the phone, like almost getting choked up the way I remember as a kid, like if I called a girl, like on back when you'd like call, I felt like, so I got an interview with Harmon and McKenna when they were interviewing new writers. And
that's amazing.
And it went well, and then I got the job, and I still kind of feel like when I remember that, I'm still like, oh my God, I got it. I think I definitely successfully made the case that there weren't many, I didn't say this, but I think I kind of made the case that like, there are a lot of really, really talented writers, but there probably aren't very many who are so right for Community, like who are so passionate about, like, because it was just like, I mean, I no exaggeration, like there wasn't a second place for like what other show I wanted to write for. Yeah. Like, I mean, there were plenty that I would have been overjoyed to write for. It was like you're a guitarist in a high school band, and they're like, you know, they're like, I don't know, an example. It's like Radiohead wants to meet with you, and you're like, what? I was gonna say Guns N' Roses Slash.
I think Megan Gantz had a similar story for her. I think she was like, I want this, and ended up getting it. So,
well, because if you're you're talking about your wife not completely getting Community, and like, if it's not for everyone, but if it's for you, it's for you. Like there, it really does stuff that that other shows don't even try to do, you know. And if that stuff that it's trying, that it's doing, is exciting to you, then like there are other shows that that are probably better shows, but that I wouldn't be as excited to write on, because don't know. It's like a genre of music that has one instance. It's like one band is playing this kind of music. So I was just, I mean, Key and Peele was, didn't exist before I wrote it. So I didn't, that Community was the first job I got where I was like, oh my God, I'm writing on my favorite show. I mean, I did feel that way about Key and Peele. You know, I loved Key and Peele. It kind of became my favorite show, but it wasn't a show that I already had a relationship with before I got hired. So that was that. And it was season five. And I went from season five to season two of Rick and Morty. I've kind of followed Dan to that and then went back to season six. And I was in the room with him when he got one of the calls anyway about season six, where he was, I mean, I think people say like the best bargaining strategy is to be able to walk away from the table. And I think I may be making this up, but I think I remember him sort of saying like, oh, I accidentally, because he didn't want to do it. He was like, I'm not going to do that. And then they like told him a number, and I never heard what the number was, but I remember him getting off the phone and being like, I didn't realize that that was one of the categories of numbers. I was talking to somebody once who had that experience where he was like, somebody wanted him to direct a movie and he was like, no. And he kept saying no. And then they kept doubling the number. And then he was like, no. And they doubled it again. And then he's like, and eventually he's just like, I guess I'm making this move. Like there's a point. That was also with Gillian. I hung out with her a lot on season six on the set. So we became really good friends. And I remember like, you know, that it was tough, that show sometimes. Yeah. And I remember like by the end of every season, everybody would be like, I never want to do this again. And then they'd be dying to do it again. But I remember I was like, if there was a season seven, would you come back? Because, and she was like, she kind of was like, I don't know. And I was like, is there an amount of money that, by the way, like true, she nailed this at the time. She called it at the time and it was true very soon after. It's like, once you're out of it, you're like, oh God, I want to go back, you know? Yeah. But it could be pretty grueling. So I just skipped over all of Community. Let's move on and talk about, got us past season six. That's what else we're talking about. Just kidding. Sorry.
That's great. I was going to ask about maybe some of the dynamic of people coming from season four to season five and what you're coming in.
And, so you know, I think there were like? Only two people who, well, I think the Red's assistant came over, but the Fabro and Tim Sicardo, I think, were the only people who had been on season four and season five. And I don't know how they felt about it. It seemed fine to me, but I don't know if they felt tension about it with Harmon. Because I mean, Harmon definitely, as was in the news, was very outspoken about how much he didn't like season four and felt. But yeah, I mean, they just didn't really talk about it that much. And I'm working with him now too, and I think he's a very evolved person. I think he sees it that he had some kind of like toxic tendencies back then that he's sort of learned, he's become a healthier person. But there definitely was a little bit of a like dysfunctional family dynamic there a little bit. I remember talking to Bob Rowe where I think Bob Rowe certainly had some mixed feelings, I think, about the whole thing. And I think Sicardo was more, I mean, partly because Sicardo was, you know, newer writer. You know, he had been, last time I worked with Harmon, he was a writer's assistant, I think. And then became a writer in season four. And then was so I think he was more sort of just like upbeat and excited and positive. And Bob Rowe's hilarious. I mean, I think Bob Rowe's like, he's like, can be kind of like snarky. Actually, I haven't talked to that guy for a while. Last time I talked to him, he was working on Last Man on Earth. I think, who was it? There was somebody I was talking to on season six who put it really well, where he was like the relationship used to feel, and doesn't really anymore, but it used to feel a little bit like like a family with a scary dad, you know, or like it's like he like this guy. Somebody was like, yeah, I think we all had weird relationships with our dads, like you know, everybody on this show, because it was a little bit like, what mood is dad in today? Yeah, I mean, overall, I think in season five, the attitude was like excitement and positivity.
Sure.
Except for when it got bogged down and like,
yeah. But, let's talk about your episode, Cooperative Polygraphy. It's one of my favorites, especially when you pair it with Cooperative Calligraphy. I think they're both like classic bottle episodes, all dialogue, and just it's amazing. Do you remember much about the pitching sessions of those episodes?
Yeah, I mean, a fair amount. I mean, that's another one where I feel very, very fortunate because in all lack of humility, I think I wrote a great script. In all humility, you know, by the time I felt so lucky to be given that script to write. And it's not like I generated it out of nothing. You know, I mean, we were, you know, breaking the season, breaking the episodes. By the time I wrote it, Chris McKenna had already written like a beat sheet, I think, for it. Like we knew, because as a group we had figured out how it would go, you know, what the basic story of it was, what the basic structure of it was, how it would unfold. I remember being in a room with like whiteboards, kind of making, you know, we were all brainstorming, I think before I knew I was going to write it, brainstorming like revelations that could come out and trying to sort them, being like, what's more of a betrayal that they that, you know, that Abed the tracking devices in their brains, or that you know, that Shirley was feeding meat to Britta, like, because you have to, because again, when in create, you know, referencing heightening, like, you don't want to go both comedically and for the story, you need to, like, it needs to unfold in a certain way, and it's not just about heightening too, because it's also when they start turning on, you know, driving it themselves, and what is Pierce really trying to do, and how do they get out of it? But yeah, I mean, writing that, I wrote that script, I think they gave it to me because they could tell that I was so passionate about the show and had the voices in my head, you know, and I mean, it was just such a joy to write it, because it kind of felt like I was in the show, you know, it's like I'm steeped in these characters and their voices and the rhythms of the show, and the and just to be able to go through and generate that, and I also felt very lucky. People, that script was, well, again, the non-humble part is I think I nailed it, you know, but
they chose it for the table read, so
I think so. But they liked, yeah, my draft was good, and that was very validating. The draft got a really good response, and that made me feel like, okay, I do belong here. And then all the, you know, you get to be on set for your script, so I was on set for that week, it was really season six that I got to be friends with some of those people, but
yeah. Okay. Yeah. Did you get? Did you have Walton Goggins in mind for that? For Mr. Stone, or was that kind of like
pretty early on? Maybe right from the beginning. I mean, not me. I'm trying to remember.
This is the guy.
It was either right in the beginning. It was either right in the beginning or soon after the beginning. I think I remember McKenna was like, it's got to be Walton. But yeah, I mean, he was amazing, and really nice too, and really intense. Like, he really cared, you know, which is nice. But yeah, that process was great, and the room was great. It felt, and it's funny, you know, like, as I'm sure you know, like, every episode, like, what it means to have written by credit on an episode depends. Like, you never know, like, when you just see it. And in that one, I was pretty lucky writing with Harmon. Like, I think, for the most part, my episodes, like, I really did write it in some sense, you know. I think it's always safe to think of every Community episode, except for season four, as each one having kind of been at least shared writing credit with Harmon. And also fair to think of it as being the entire writing staff, because everybody's involved, everybody's breaking it, everybody's rewriting it, everybody's punching up jokes. But yeah, that episode I'm able to have a kind of pride in, partly because I felt like I really did my part. But there are some other, you know, there's other things in the season that I'm proud of that I don't have credit for. Like one of my favorite, one thing I remember, I was part of the like sort of sub, there were, I feel like there were like four or five people in a room late at night who came up with the whole thing with like the theater that Chang walks into. It was like a seat story and that thing. Yeah. And like, pretty sure I pitched, because I think it was like, he leaves the theater and then the janitor's like, there hasn't been a show in there in 30 years. And I think I pitched that he goes back, either I pitched that he goes back in there and said, yeah, I think I pitched that he goes back in there and he's like, he said, you're a bunch of ghosts. And then he comes, and then they tell him that they haven't had a janitor in 30 years or something. Like, just little things like that, that were just like really fun to arrive at. Cause at its best, that in a way, like the most fun is when you're generating ideas together and it almost feels like a heightened version of watching a funny show. You know, it's like you're in community, you know, you're like, the joy of creating some of this comedy is a version of the joy of experiencing it as an audience member. Sure. But that was true of season six too. In season six, I was on set I became the set guy. So for the first few months before production started, I was in the room, but then for pretty much the whole rest of it, I was on set. Sort of as, because you know, the showrunners can't be writing the show and be on set all the time. So I kind of was, either the positive spin is that they trusted me. The negative spin is that they knew I was like, I was loyal. I don't know, but I was sort of the eyes and ears for McKenna and Harmon and was there trying to represent. It's kind of like a super director in a way. I mean, not super, not more authority or creative, but I was there to be like, oh no, we got to get it this way. This is not like, we needed this. We need that. Like, no, let's not do that. So, and that's when I got to like live in Greendale. Like, I mean, I spent a lot of time like in the library, you know, which was kind of amazing. And that was when, Gillian and I became good friends and then all the cast too, like just, you know, very, like it was really great hanging out with them. Danny's the nicest person in the world.
Yeah.
And Jim Rash is the nicest person in the world.
Ken.
Ken is the nicest person in the world. Yeah. They're all Yvette. The nicest person in the world.
You didn't get to have Yvette in.
Yeah.
In
did not. Six. Yvette, I did not. Yeah. And Donald had already left. I got to talk to him a little bit in season five. But he was already kind of like, I think the main interaction I had with him, I think he was kind of like ready to go. And I had just listened to one of his EPs or something. And I was like, hey, it was really good. And he was like, and then he lit up. Cause I think his head was in Childish Gambino at that point.
Yeah.
And Chevy was gone already. But that was a dream, you know, like getting to hang out with the cast of Community on the set of Community for months.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I've done it for about an hour plus at a time, and it's been amazing. And doing it full time, it would be pretty amazing. Yeah. Hey, the fandom would be really upset if I didn't ask a few questions specifically.
Sure,
So one is, are you allowed to reveal where Abed's tracking chips are?
Oh.
Obligated?
The funny answer is no. And the real answer is I don't think we ever actually. Yeah. I think it's one of those things like the Pulp Fiction briefcase, you know, where it's
fair enough.
I'll stick with no. I can't. I'm not allowed.
Okay. All right. Let's keep it going. I like it. Do you agree with Abed or Jeff about the movie The Gray?
I agree with Abed.
Not so good.
Well, I mean, I just couldn't believe that. I mean, look, I don't like to yuck people's yum, and I think I can get my head around being like, oh, that's cool. But I know maybe it's the marketing that was the problem. That you go into you go into a movie that's like, it's Liam Neeson fighting wolves, and then literally the movie ends with him about to fight the wolves. I'm like, spoiler alert, but I'm like, no. Like Star Wars without the lightsaber fight.
Exactly, yeah. I'm your end scene. The table read was amazing. Loved it. There is one thing about the fandom that they have a question for you.
Sure.
There's a line about Annie having a secret key to Jeff's apartment in the table read that's not in the TV show.
Yeah, I think that just came from the table read. I mean, I can check the old scripts, but I don't think that was an original thing. But yeah, no, I'd have to look that up.
Okay.
Sorry, I'm not helpful. No. I'm not.
No. When we promo this, you'll do some research for me.
Yeah.
And when we tweet it out, you'll have to tell us that, because that's a big one.
Yeah.
We'll just touch briefly on season six then.
Yeah.
This is kind of a new writing territory for you going to Yahoo. What was that life? I guess we kind of touched on a little bit, but we talked about at the beginning of the interview, there's definitely a different vibe to season six.
Yeah.
You know, tell me about that. There's a little bit more cynicism in it. It just feels, we're getting a little bit of a different part of Dan.
Well, you know, in some ways, like, I mean, yes, definitely. Like, in some ways, it didn't feel different. And I think it's a combination of things. Part of it is just, you know, slightly more freedom. Like, the fact that the pacing could be a little bit different. You didn't have to cram it into, you know, whatever it was, 22 minutes or something. Yeah. But also part of it is that, I mean, you know, the sort of, like, legend of Community, legend of Dan Harmon take on it, which I think is not untrue, is partly that, you know, Community was always, even as a fan before I started writing the show, you know, it was always on the edge of being canceled. It was always a show that, you know, I used to think of it as a show, and he got fired, you know, like, yeah, you know, like, right. I used to think of it as a thing where it's like, what another example of how true genius never, like, the man will never let it shine. Although I've come to think of it almost the opposite, that, like, part of the achievement of Community is that it took something so crazy and weird and had it be on NBC for 5 seasons, you know, and then we had another season. Like, and we touched a lot of people, you know, and instead of viewing it cynically as a story about how brilliant, amazing, creative stuff can never make it, it's almost the opposite, you know. It's just a question of what you know, what you're focusing on. But I think that it is true that Harmon said, I mean, I had nothing to do with him at the time, so I only know this from, but I believe him, that when he wrote the pilot for Community, he was like, okay, time to sell out. Like, you know, I can't make the stuff that I want to make. I'm smart enough that I can generate a sitcom that can be on NBC. Like, and he did. And then by, you know, pretty soon, all the crazy creative, you know, genre bending, form breaking stuff started to flood in. But, but in a way, the story of Community was always like fighting the network, being on the cusp of cancellation. Will they be renewed? Will they not be renewed? Is he going to get fired? Is he going to get rehired? Yeah. Season five, you know, getting hired and then rehired kind of makes you bulletproof in a way. And yet it also puts a lot of pressure on him to prove himself. You know, it's like, okay, well, to his, you know, in a way that I'm sure he was gratified by, and this is why he got rehired. And the consensus was, oh yeah, no, you can't fire Dan Harmon from Community, not because you know who I am, but because Community without Dan Harmon isn't Community. So I'm sure that was very gratifying to him, you know, to be like, okay, we have to bring you back for this glorious return. And, like, that narrative is very validating, but then you got to make sure you don't blow it. You know, you don't want people to be like, actually, season four is better than season five. So, so there's still, like, you know, a lot of pressure, and also in a way, he was still engaged in this fight. You know, like, You know, still proving himself to some extent. And then I think with season six, like, as I think I mentioned earlier, I think he legitimately like felt like he was done with it. I don't think he wanted to do a season six. And once, like, Yahoo really was kind of like, I mean, they knew what they had. They're like, yes, this is Dan Harmon. Now do your thing. Now no more pushback, no more fighting, no more, you know, evil corporation trying to prevent you from being a genius. Like, be a genius, please. That's what we bought you for, you know? Yeah. And I think, so again, like, I think the legend of Dan Harmon, the legend of Community, which, and I don't say legend to indicate that it's not true, is that once he had no one to rebel against, no one to fight against, he kind of had to fight against himself, you know? So essentially it's like in season six, like so much of what made Community what it was this like, you know, like the underdog fighting its way, you know, clawing up through the soil, like Uma Thurman in Kill Bill Volume 2, you know, like so much of the energy of Community was that. And then suddenly it's like, oh, here we are. And it's like, so, and I was on set for a lot of the room. I kind of got the impression that some of the experience in the room in season six got pretty dark. I think everybody was kind of unhappy up there, down in the bowels of the earth where I was in set. It was a little better, but yeah, I mean, it was kind of like, sort of like discovering that it's like being in a punk group and suddenly you're the biggest band in the world and the politics of the world have changed. And I glanced at a review of the new Godspeed You
Black Emperor.
Yeah. Is that what's called? Godspeed You Black Emperor?
I think so.
I don't know the band really well. I actually just started listening to them for the first time really, really late, just recently. And I saw somebody saying like, this is their first album where they kind of sound a little hopeful, where they're kind of like, maybe the good guys are going to win because, you know, they're political, I guess. But I think it's sort of like, what are you if you win? So I think that that's part of the thing with Community season six is that in some ways it was an ability to just sort of do whatever you want. And in some ways it was the consequence of that that's negative. Some of the stuff, that's my favorite in that season. I gather that they were controversial, but I really like some of the tags.
In your episode, there's the Gremlins tag.
Yes, which by the way, like it was my idea to have there be a, I think actually I originally pitched that it was the original Gremlins that Steven Spielberg ripped off. And I think Harmon was like, no, it's gotta be the Portuguese ripoff of Gremlins. But really that tag is Schraub. Like he wrote and I don't know if I'm allowed to say like directed it, and it's just a Schraub masterpiece, that little tag. I've said only half or not jokingly that I'm just very grateful that I get writing credit on it because I didn't write it, and I'm proud of it even though I don't deserve to be. It was my idea, but literally just Portuguese Gremlins was my idea, and then there's just, I just love that tag. There's a lot of stuff in that season that I love. I felt kind of a certain kind of ownership, not ownership, but I felt proud of the Karate Kid episode. I felt like I sort of a pre Cobra Kai Karate Kid appreciation. I really loved that. There's that like speech that that Jason has about, you know, Miyagi being the real, like, Miyagi is the center. And the finale I love, and I had really nothing to do with it. I mean, I was there, you know, I was involved with every scene. But I didn't write. You know, I saw those pages coming in, and I was just like, okay, this episode's crazy, and I love it. I also really liked, I got the impression that this was a controversial one too, but I liked Wedding Videography. I mean, I think
at its... I love it.
Oh, good.
I
think at its best, season six was like, okay, let's do Community, but with like, with a little bit more freedom to like the place where Community would diverge from a sitcom tone or structure or standards or whatever in the previous seasons, it had to be like really tight, you know, because it's like, well, it still is in the, but here it kind of could be like, okay, this episode is going to be like this. And it was like a little bit more, it was a little bit more kind of almost free form. And I think that plus the maybe bad vibes going on in the writer's room, and Harmon being unhappy. And also Harmon was, you know, he at the beginning of that season, he got married, and not long after that season, he got divorced, you know? Yeah. And so I think he was, you know, he was going through some shit. But also right, that was right around when, I think it was because I think that, I think Harmon's so open. I don't think I'm speaking out of turn to talk about this stuff, although I'm self, but I think he's talked about this, that, you know, he started, I think because of going and getting married, he started doing couples therapy. Yeah. And that is how he got into therapy. Finally. Like when I first started listening to Harmontown, I remember like one of the few things he said where I was like, oh, well, that's right. He was like, therapy's for stupid people. And I think the audience was like, boo. He was like, oh, I don't know. Okay, I don't know. But like, and now he's like, I think very pro therapy. And I think he discovered therapy, and I think it really helped him a lot. But I think it was, that was a period when it's like a lot of unhappiness and frustration.
Yeah. I think he gets felt a little bit in, but at the same time, you have some really, I love wedding videography. The Keith David speech is one of the best moments in Community. You just keep on wearing those pants.
And they, the song. But also, by the way, I just rewatched part of that episode, and this is maybe self-mythologizing, like the Gremlins 2 thing that I'm inadvertently. But I remember, like, right when it was about to go live, somebody asked me. They were like, "Was that you who said let him finish?" And I was like, "I can't remember." And they're like, "We're trying to decide whether it was you or this other guy in the crew who often would do like random voices." And I was like, I don't know, so just let it, like, I don't want to claim credit. And then the more and more I'm like, yeah, that was definitely me. Like, I like recognize my voice. I like but I like that joke too. Yeah, he's like, so let him finish. They were letting me finish. I know, I was being sarcastic. So, and this is the whole, I was so delighted by the tag of that one too. The like having the fake writer's room, and he's like, "Hi, I'm Briggs Haddon," and they said that it was, he's like just really leaning into the incest thing and be like, "This is an episode about incest." That made me laugh. That's my shit.
That's really good. So I think at this point, you know, for you, you know, going right into Rick and Morty, you did season 2. You did Big Trouble and Little Sanchez, really, really funny episode, Tiny Rick. And then speaking of couples therapy-ish. The dynamic with...
Jerry and Beth.
And, you know, just, it's really funny. Tell, you know, what was it like then going, you know, working with Dan again? It seems like there was, you know, there had to have been some synergy with you two, to use a business term in it, but...
Yeah.
But you, clearly there's a working relationship there that's a really positive one.
Well, I've always, I mean, I love Dan and him. I mean, I love him personally, but also just creatively, he really is a genius. Like, I've been very lucky to work with a couple people who, it's funny. I think I must come off as one of those people who calls everybody a genius, but it's because I've actually worked with a couple of actual geniuses.
Yeah, you worked with Key and Peele. Okay. Yeah. You know, they're pretty amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Harmon, I mean, Harmon and Jordan are, I mean, Keegan is also a genius, but I mean, in terms of writing, like Keegan's not more, you know, he's a brilliant comedian. Jordan is just like one of the best writers I know, and Harmon too. And Harmon's like, you know, I'm working with him again because I worked on season 2 of Rick and Morty, and then I came back for season 6, and now I'm working on season 7. Season 5 hasn't even come out yet, but I'm working on season 7, and it's just like, it's so fun and inspiring working with Harmon, because he really, just the way he sees and understands story and comedy, and also, I mean, he'll just, you literally, like, he can just shit out a brilliant, like, sketch, like a, like, just his just his default is to generate this incredible stuff, and he's so smart. I think working on season two of Rick and Morty was much, it was sort of felt like a continuation of, I mean, or just a more distilled, because it was a smaller group. Guterman was there, Ridley was there. Ridley was, you know, there from the start. He was practically created the show with Roiland and Harmon. And then Matt Roller was there too. Now it's, I'm the only one there from the community days. Well, Steve Levy, who started working as Harmon's assistant in season six of Community, is a producer on the show and is there in the room a lot. But now it's, now I feel like an old veteran or something. But in season two, it was a little, a sort of like small contingent of kind of like Harmon guys from Community. And then, and again, some of the stuff I'm proudest of was not even on my episode then. And some of the stuff that I liked the most from my episode weren't even from me. I mean, I think it was Matt Roller who pitched the idea. I love it so much that like part of the way they defeat, I mean, this was just like, you know, so you in it, when the room's working really well, it's hard to pinpoint who pitched what, because it becomes this just like group mind. But there's a whole thing where there's like this helmet that they put on, and then it will, this machine will generate your unconscious idealization of the other person. And when Jerry bursts in to rescue Beth, who's wearing this thing, and it's generating these worm Jerrys, who can be an army for the bad guy, and the idea that when Jerry bursts in to rescue her, the Jerrys that are popping out of the machine start becoming like muscular kind of, and the idea that, I can't remember whether he pitched that or whether he pitched, I think I don't remember which is which, but I just give Roller gets credit for whatever was best about all that. And because there's also the thing that I think I pitched this, that the way they end up beating her is that he realizes that, I think when he puts the thing on, he puts the helmet on one of the Jerrys that she generated when he was being cool. Right. And he realizes that Jerry's conception of her is a goddess, stuff like that. And then also but my favorite was the Tiny Rick storyline. I mean, the whole thing about them, like him come like the trapped Rick inside talking through the Tiny Rick's art, like when drawing a picture as this, get, you know, help me, Summer and Morty. And Dan Guterman pitched, like, we were writing the thing where it's like they're doing a dance and he's going, let me out. And Guterman pitched, this is not a dance, which I really like. Guterman's brilliant too. Also, like, you know, Community, both seasons of Community and Rick and Morty season two were very, very late nights. Whereas now, now we're in a Zoom room, so it can't be that. But I gather that sort of stopped anyway. But there was a time, I remember in season five of Community, I remember getting out of work at, I don't know, I think it was like 12:30 a.m. on Friday night, and calling my wife and saying, hey, we got out early. And then realizing like, oh wait, that's crazy. I just said we got out early. It was not at all. I mean, the hardest part about it actually was just, you never knew when you'd be done with work. You didn't know whether, if you got out of work before dinner, that was like, if you're at work and they're like, you come in and they're like, we're not actually doing work today. And you're like, oh, okay. So like dinner was just like, of course you're staying for dinner. And occasionally you wouldn't, but you never knew whether, like, are we going to be done at 8 p.m. or are we going to be done at 11 p.m. or are we going to be done at 3 a.m. or occasionally are you going to stay till tomorrow? So the uncertainty was the hardest part. I think if you just were like, okay, guess what? You are leaving tomorrow afternoon. Then you can brace yourself for it and be like, okay, here we're doing it. But just to never know when you're getting out. That was in a way the hardest part.
Well, we appreciate your dedication, your long hours, because you've helped create a show that both Rick and Morty and Community, as well as everything that you've touched, has been, I think I'll speak at least on the behalf of Community, because I'm doing this, but we just really appreciate your work. And appreciate your writing, your dedication, and the jokes that have, and stories and relationships that have kept us going in some cases. You know, I think there's a lot of people who've really struggled, especially over this last year. You know, it's been amazing to have Community on Netflix for a year now. And you know, there's hundreds of thousands of new fans. You know, we get new fans all the time checking out podcasts and Twitter feeds and that kind of thing.
Well, I've got a foot in both camps, because you know, I was a huge fan before I got to write on the show. But speaking on the other side of the line, there's a lot of gratitude and wonder and appreciation for the fans too. I mean, both from the cast and from the writers. I mean, it's really like, I mean, that's part of what I meant when I said that, you know, I used to think of it like another story about unappreciated genius. And it's like, no, this is a story about appreciated genius. I mean, this is a story about, you know, and to make it all about Harmon, I mean, he's able to write these heady, crazy, weird things that really do connect with people on a emotional level. Like I said, I mean, like when Abed's uncontrolled, it's a weird example for what we're talking about, but, you know, like you have an emotional, like, I mean, and that's, I think that's also what I meant earlier about, I think that at its best, Community and Rick and Morty too, but I mean, really Community, like, manages to connect with people on an emotional level, partly because it doesn't shy away from the darkness, you know? And I think as someone who, I don't know, like everyone, or at least like a lot of people who has, you know, dealt with depression and dealt with, you know, dark times. There's a magic to it that I'm just feel very lucky to have gotten to be involved with at all. And I think it is the magic of reaching. That's by the way, actually, the Winger speech in Abed's Uncontrollable Christmas is about that, about Christmas. It's about, he defines Christmas as the crazy idea that the longest, coldest, darkest night can be the brightest and warmest, you know? And in a way, that is what we're talking about. I mean, anyway, but yes, I huge appreciation of and gratitude for the fans and the community.
Sure.
It's really, it's an amazing thing to get to be a part of on all sides. And I'm lucky enough to have been on both sides. So it's special.
Yeah. Well, Alex Rubens, a writer of season 5 and 6 on Community, and check out his work on a number of other things, including Twilight Zone. But he's been on 6 seasons of the podcast. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.